New Galaxy Broadcasting proudly presents Integrative Hermetic Health with Hugo Rodier, MD. In this program, we explore a powerful new paradigm for health from the standpoint of integrative medicine. In his practice, Dr. Rodier integrates the ancient Hermetic art and the enduring role of food as medicine with modern nutrition, but also allowing for the wide range of important health practices, including truly valuable medical discoveries, chiropractic, acupuncture, homeopathic and herbal medicine. In this program, Hugo Rodier, an expert in intestinal health and nutrition, will help the audience discover an approach that focuses on actual cures, not the masking of the elegant simplicity of many health solutions for the sake of profit. Profit too long has been an overriding motive of the pharmaceutical companies, and sometimes, sadly, by many in the medical establishment today. In this program, we'll be discussing a very serious but perhaps not publicly well-known fact about the medical profession. According to Dr. Louise Andrew, MD, updating an article on physician suicide in Medscape, quote, "For over 150 years, it has been known that medical doctors have a very high rate of suicide." She further adds, quote, "It was estimated in 1977 that on an average, the United States loses the equivalent of at least one small medical school or a large medical school class to suicide. Exact numbers are not known, although it is impossible to estimate with accuracy because of inaccurate cause of death reporting and coding. The number most often used is approximately 300 to 400 physicians a year, or perhaps a doctor a day. Of all occupations and professions, the medical profession consistently hovers near the top of occupations with the highest risk of death by suicide," end quote. Now, you don't have suicide coming out of a void. There's got to be a great deal of depression and anxiety preceding an act as desperate as this. The reality is that an amazing number of doctors live in a state of depression, with many of them contemplating suicide. Today, our host, Hugo Rodier, MD, an integrative physician, will talk about his personal awareness of this problem at an early age and then go to the facts and reality of this curious set of facts and how to invoke some kind of realistic change. Good morning, Dr. Rodier.
Good morning, Johnny. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, here we go with a quite interesting program that I imagine that many people listening may not have even known that this was a problem. How did you first become aware of the psychological problems possibly connected to the medical profession?
Well, even before medical school, I had some reservations about going into medicine. I felt like it was a little too fuddy-duddy for me. Felt like it was a bit rigid. But nonetheless, I felt called to become a doctor. And so I took a year to do a health administration master work, mm-hmm. a graduate work. And so it helped. I became more aware of the political and economic pressures on the system and on doctors. But not only that, I became aware of the time pressure on doctors. So as self-serving as a young man can be, I chose my master thesis on the difference between doctors who at the time were beginning to be employed by HMOs as opposed to doctors who remain in the traditional sacrosanct fee-for-service model, the private system.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that time in the 70s, HMOs were communist, or I should say, people thought there was some communist plot to take over America because they were felt to be so socialist, if you will, or outside the norm that is fee-for-service. Right. So I interviewed two groups of doctors from both groups, and I began to see that really there wasn't that much difference between the doctors except for age. So the younger doctors did not feel that the HMOs were such a contaminated way to practice, whereas the older doctors, of course, you know, preferred the fee-for-service system. So I became aware that the time pressures on doctors, the way they chose to practice, the number of hours, where they chose to practice, was all their own making. They chose how to do it. And so I figured, okay, well then, when I become a doctor, if accepted, because I was still applying, I will call my own shots. I will do whatever it is I want to do. And so the seeds were planted for my roguish mind to go through medical school, picking and choosing, planning on what to do when I graduated in and was able to study what I really wanted to study in medical school. I was very disappointed and depressed at the same time. I remember my wife at the time picking me up, and I just trying to keep a stiff upper lip. But as soon as she rounded the corner down the hill from the medical school, I began pounding on the dashboard because she was driving. I hate my expletive life. And so she drove home in silence, you know, very respectful. My feelings, when I got home, I couldn't even eat. And so I told her, I said, I'm totally miserable. I thought I was the only one, of course, you know, but I wasn't. Many other students were depressed. And even today, many medical students and doctors are depressed. You know, the buzzword right now is burnout, physician burnout, which is an epidemic, felt to be an epidemic in this country now. It's just a euphemism for depression, or another word for depression, I should say. And so what's going on? I have my own ideas as to what's going on. But before we plunge into more details about this problem, we need to put it in perspective. Number one, physicians are not the number one group with this suicide depression problem. Believe it or not, they are veterinarians.
Really?
Yeah, they're number one in suicide and depression. And, you know, that's kind of hard to fathom, you know, because we all love animals and playing with animals can be so much fun, but apparently there's a dark side to the profession, and I'm not qualified to tell you more than that.
What about the military? There's a lot of talk about military suicides.
Yes, particularly in veterans when they come home. But that's slightly different. I mean, these people have been under fire, and they come back with PTSD and a whole lot of other problems, even economic problems, because they're abandoned by the government and after serving so well. And so, yeah, they probably have more problems. But given the environment, I would say that's a cat from another bag.
Right. You know, I became your patient almost exactly at the moment before you left the particular clinic you were working at. Remember?
Uh-huh.
I know you were opting to be free of a system you found oppressive. And at the same time, you decided not to take insurance anymore. Was this action of yours a step in the area of psychological liberation for yourself? Because insurance, paperwork, activities seem to be high on the list of the doctors who experience burnout.
Yes. In fact, that's cited as number one disappointment for doctors, that they are no longer able to relate to patients because of these time pressures, you know, the bean counters outside the door holding a stopwatch, the medical records, or I should say digital medical records. Now they're demanded to fill in all these boxes and write these super notes for insurance companies to pay them back, that they hardly look at the patient in the eye. I mean, talk about disconnect. So there's a whole lot of pressures, not only on patients, but on doctors. I don't know any doctor who's happy about this. In fact, the other day I had a great talk with a patient. We talked for 2 hours, his first time out, and I have unlimited visits because I love to lollygag with patients. You know, I think that's part of the therapy.
Yeah.
To tell you the truth. So lollygagging with this patient who turns out to be a lawyer, and it starts to come out that because of those time pressures at the other clinic that he just left, the guy is totally unhappy because he has been mistreated. Over prescribing of hormones and a few other drugs, excessive testing, etc. So being a lawyer, he was just sharpening his knives, you know, ready to sue. So I calmed him down. I said, listen, and we'll talk more about this later. This poor doc that you had helping you, it's under the gun. The poor guy is probably depressed. He's not any happier than you with the system. He's just forced to do that. And so I calmed him down, and I went home and I took a nap. So yeah, the clinic I was in, I joined 20 years ago after IHC let me go for lollygagging with patients, you know, and IHC is a big conglomerate here in Salt Lake City.
Right.
And so I joined this other clinic of nurse practitioners, and being that they're wet behind the ears, they took my direction as to how to practice integratively, spend time with patients and all that. But gradually, since they were the clinic owners, They began to roll over insurance companies by the pressure of insurance companies, and they began to act much like any regular clinic, over prescribing, over testing, and so it was time to quit.
Yeah.
Now, I'm all by myself. I answer the phone. I have no staff. I lollygag with patients. I still get some paperwork because of laboratory and medical records requests, which are very upsetting because they come from very compulsive, micromanaging people and codes and this and that. So I can't quite leave the system in the United States, but I did as much as I could, and I'm very happy I did. And my income now is a fourth of what a regular doctor makes. But you know, at 65, how much money do you need when you have everything paid for? So I'm fine. So I go home, take a nap, and go back and lollygag with my patients.
Yeah, well, it's definitely a more comforting experience than I've had with other doctors recently. I remember back when I was a kid, it was different. I remember the pediatrician that we used. He was really affable, you know. It was like a more relaxed type of thing. Now it's more like an assembly line.
Well, back then, that pediatrician of yours owned his clinic. He paid his staff. He was free to do whatever he wanted, and then in the chart, he'd write chicken scratch, ear infection, amoxicillin, and poof, that's it. All right?
Yeah.
That was enough for that good doc to know what the visit was about. He didn't need to spill every little single detail and et cetera, for the insurance company and the lawyers and everybody else. So, you see, I mean, truly, docs have a bit of a responsibility in this. Not too much. We'll talk about that. In that they abdicated their control to the bean counters. So whoever signs the check calls the shots.
Yeah.
And so that good doc is well gone, except in Sandy, Utah, where I practice.
Well, this is very, very interesting, but we need to take a break now for a few minutes, and we'll be right back. We'll now have a few messages followed by a song I wrote as lyricist with composer Edgar Ahrens. I think it is appropriately titled for a program dealing with the machinations and stresses put on physicians by avaricious pharmaceutical and insurance companies and the political corporate lobbies which support them. It's called Desperate Games and performed by our colleague, the amazing Patricia Welch. This is Johnny Bluestar, CEO of New Galaxy Enterprises, a media content development company. The original productions by Amazon, Hulu, and Netflix in particular has opened up a new and powerful form of television that has both global income and still unexplored profit potential as convergence between offline and online media continues to blossom. We can help persons needing creative help to turn their ideas for television pilots into actionable, marketable scripts. There's probably nothing more exciting in the field of entertainment than these new vistas online as that capacity crosses more and more to the big screen. And the opportunities for instantaneous online projections of any type of media in that perennially popular venue. To learn more about New Galaxy, see samples of our work, or talk to us about your project, please go to www.newgalaxyenterprises.com and fill out the contact form. Patriots Act is a Brent Marks legal thriller written by Kenneth Ede, a novelist and attorney, often appearing on Threshold Radio. It's about Ahmed, a naturalized U.S. citizen formerly of Iraq, who was sent to Guantanamo Bay detention camp with no real knowledge of a crime he has committed. Brent Marks, a California attorney, is originally hired by Ahmed's wife to fight for his release. The novel opens with a convincing mock execution, a mode of torture meant to break down a prisoner in a brutal and traumatic way that foreshadows Ahmed's actual death in the hands of his accusers.
Ahmed felt the butt of the rifle strike his spine as his knees buckled and he hit the floor.
Move faster, Haji. Up against the wall. Stop there. Good. Listen up. My name is Sergeant Brown. You're here because you refused to cooperate in the interrogations. The decision has been made to execute you by firing squad.
Wait, I'm an American citizen.
Ahmed felt the black bag rip from his head and for the first time faced his aggressors. He found himself facing a man in camouflage fatigues, holding an M16 to his chest. Beside him, an 8-man firing squad with their rifles in ready position.
I have the right to talk to an attorney. This is all a big mistake.
Brown fastened a leather strap around Ahmed's waist, pinning his spine to a wooden post.
Yeah, a big mistake. You should have cooperated when we asked you about your superiors in Al-Qaeda.
I don't know anyone in Al-Qaeda.
Do you have any last statement, Haji?
But I...
I repeat, do you have any last statement?
I'm not a terrorist. I'm an American citizen. I've right to a lawyer and a trial. You've denied me these rights. You will answer to God for your crimes.
I think you can see who has all the rights here. Ready? Aim!
The ape pointed the rifles at Ahmed. Shivering uncontrollably, Ahmed's knees gave way, and he hung on the post like a man crucified.
Fire!
The deafening explosion of the eight rifles was the last thing Ahmed heard. He felt the bullets hit his flesh, and his body crumpled forward, hanging lifelessly from the post like a scarecrow.
Your shadow marks the brazen breeze. I sense you're near and slowly freeze. Tempted by your lips and your touch, the cup of you is way too much. I drink from you.
Shadow spark.
This is Johnny Bluestar. I'm back with Dr. Hugo Rodier on the Integrative Hermetic Health Show, and we are discussing a very interesting but sad topic, which is the causes and the reality of physician depression and suicide. You know, one of the things I was curious about in our last conversation is the fact that you have a physician burnout, and then you have depression. What is the difference, actually? When does burnout become depression? Could you kind of describe that?
Yes, you know, this is much like PTSD. You know, I'm glad that you brought that up as far as the military goes. It turns out that PTSD is a whole lot more common in the grunts. You know, the soldiers are shaking in their boots, waiting for the captain or the lieutenant, even the sergeant, to tell them what to do, when to hightail or move or protect themselves. So officers in control have much less PTSD. It's the grunts that don't know what's next, what's coming next, that have most of the PTSD. So what I'm leading at is the issue of control. And so when docs are losing control, they cannot relate to patients as they would like, et cetera, as discussed, they begin to burn out. And if that control is unrelenting, the next step is depression.
Well, what is the difference? What is the difference between the burnout phenomena or symptoms and depression?
Well, depression is a diagnosis when you have a cluster of symptoms, so it's a medical diagnosis. Burnout is more of a social term that is one of the factors that leads to depression. So I don't think they're equal. You can be burnt out and not depressed, because a whole lot of people, when they're burnt out, they're just angry. All right, or they cope by not showing up or calling in sick or whatever. But when you persist in that situation, you don't take steps to alleviate the burnout and you lose total control, then you're likely to become depressed.
I see. Okay. And could you talk about some of the symptoms of depression?
Well, sure. We have them all codified and doctors will look for it. But, you know, it's nothing that the regular person cannot spot in their loved ones. So it's feelings of fatigue, lack of sleep, anxiety, blue feelings, even feelings of wanting to hurt oneself, hopelessness. Even physical symptoms can start to manifest themselves, headaches, intestinal problems like ISB, irritable bowel syndrome, although there are many other factors that enter into that gut problem. And so the symptoms can be proteous. In fact, in the elderly, we see a lot of confusion and forgetting. So a lot of elders get even more depressed, thinking, oh my gosh, now I have Alzheimer's. When in reality, a whole lot of elderly people are just depressed. And the young, it can be very sneaky, the symptoms of depression, because not knowing what's going on, the young can try to camouflage these symptoms. So it can be poor relations within the family, drug abuse, oppositional disorder, etc. So a doctor does well to look for those symptoms, not only in their patients, but in themselves.
You know, what I hear is that the generally speaking, there's more depression in physicians than the general population. But even more so, there's more depression supposedly in common in medical students and residents. Than there are in physicians, who are people who have gotten to that point of practicing medicine.
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up. The medical training in medical school, and then it gets worse in internship and residency, it has gotten better. I must say that. But at the time I was an intern and a resident, there were rotations when I had to work 120 hours a week.
God.
And yeah. I mean, I remember this one time I was just getting slammed by a whole lot of admissions. So it's 3 a.m. and the creepy ICU nurse who they love to boss over doctors in training. Well, it's a generalization, of course. You know, I'm trying to spice this thing up a little. She says, "Hey, Dr. Rodia, you can't go to bed. You have yet another admission, number 7, which was a record at the time for that hospital." Okay, well, so I get in the elevator to go down to the ER to receive the patient. And just as I'm stepping into the elevator, a page goes off. I can hear it. Dialed 9 something or other. All right. So I get in the elevator and I start punching that extension on the elevator pad. All right.
Yeah.
And I just go nuts because the pad did not have a number 9 because the building was only 6 floors high. And I start pounding that pad. How do you expect me to answer this effing page if you don't? And then it dawns on me, you know. And so, do you want me to take care of you, Johnny, in that condition at 3 a.m.?
No, I would prefer somebody else to. maybe the janitor or somebody.
Right. He or she could have done a better job. Anyway, it's got better. It's gotten better, but it's still an issue. And I think it'll continue to get better. I see a lot of hope, even though it's still dark, okay? It's bound to happen, and that's what we'll be addressing, I think, next. At a gut level, doctors know what the problem is. They know what they want to do, and they're frustrated that it's not happening.
Right, because
but it will.
So one person said, you know, talking about medical school, this was a lady who was a consultant about physician suicide. She was talking about her own experience, and she says, basically, that the medical education is like a 17th century phenomena. And what you're doing is and it was created then, and you're looking at people who want you to look at things in terms of, you know, intestines and hearts and, you know, the sort of rags and reality of just the physical being. In this process, the way it's done, you kind of lose your soul.
Exactly.
And you've come there to help. You've come there to help people, not just to tinker with their bodies.
Yes. Most people who want to be doctors, I mean, think about it. Why would you want to be up to your elbows in muck and blood and disaster and trauma? You know, there's got to be a motivation there that's more humanistic where you want to help. I got to tell you, though, this is the other side of the coin. I served for 15 years as a member of the admissions committee for the University of Utah Medical School. And I saw that most applicants that got in were super duper smart kids with very little humanity. Of course, the kids who had both were the ones who got admitted first. But I always voted for the more balanced types, you know, the B type of students instead of the A plus. The kids that went into history and English and public health and psychology and philosophy rather than chemistry and physics and all that. Look, it's a mix, but what I'm saying is we are unbalanced in the way we're admitting doctors. So a lot of doctors find that after they get to practice, just tinkering with the mechanics of the problem, as you described it, it's not enough. I mean, you can micromanage all those things and memorize all the stuff that has to do with a disease or a part of the body, but if you don't stop to look at the patient's eyes and see that patient as a human being, you know, you're going to get burnt out. That's the bottom line.
You know, I understand that there's a stigma, and I think I've heard about this, you know, in just talking about your feelings of depression, reporting depression to a doctor or even to your family. But I understand that that aspect of failure to report is magnified in the physician population. Why is that?
Well, because dogs have a lot of toys to play with to mask it, even drugs. So they can dip into the cookie jar and end up taking opioids and who knows what else, and alcohol, etc. Then dogs are the medical deities. So you're not supposed to admit that you are weak. You know, all this has to be viewed in the context of the society we live in. And we've talked about this many times, Johnny. We live in a materialistic society. The material girl is not alone.
Yeah.
And so that's why this happens. Our healthcare system is a reflection of what's going on in our society as a whole. So that's why I don't feel like beating up on doctors, because they're victims themselves of a system. I mean, they're not 100% innocent. Neither are patients, by the way. It's just that we're all caught in the system. And I still have high hope that it will get better, because if we study history, we always see truth prevailing at some level. At least we can enjoy the fruits of good practices in our own little niches here and there, pockets of resistance, if you will. So at least I am hopeful that a lot of doctors will find their answer.
Well, besides the problem with suicide, the depression itself can can cause certain conditions that could favor a faster experience of mortality. In other words, they could die sooner. Like for instance, myocardial infection, I think, is related to depression, is it not, sometimes?
Well, yes. Everything is related to depression. So the mind-body connection is huge, and we've talked about that. So whenever you find chronic health problems, arthritis, diabetes, heart attacks, etc., yes, there's always an element of depression or feelings, stress, etc. So it's hard to divide the mind and the body. So yes, you do see more depression in cardiac patients, and more depressed patients have more cardiac problems.
And you have more immune suppression that would affect
exactly.
a lot of people.
Yes, exactly.
Including cancer.
Absolutely, because depression, anxiety, stress will engage the adrenal glands a whole lot more. We call it the HPA axis. And so when the adrenals are frothing, if you will, if they don't get a chance to rest, they put out 32 hormones, some of which depress the immune system. And that's why we use glucocorticoids, cortisone, prednisone, those type of drugs to suppress the immune system. Often we don't know what else to do with an overwrought immune system, so docs will prescribe adrenal-like hormones to depress the immune system. So do the math. And I just had a patient who kept getting urine infections and sore throats. And finally, well, the second time around, I said, listen, what's going on? She finally fessed up that there's a lot of turmoil in her family. She's not sleeping right, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, we need to look for those things in patients and in ourselves as physicians.
Well, we're going to have to take a break now, but when we get back, we'll kind of climb out of this mess that everybody's in and see if we can straighten it out, right?
Yes.
We'll be right back.
My company, New Galaxy Enterprises, is a California corporation specializing in the creation of media and promotional content. We are focused on original, innovative projects that are good for humanity. These projects could be nonfiction books or novels, fictional screenplays or documentary content, websites and website content, commercial advertising content for print, audio, or video products on the internet, television, or radio, musical scores for advertising, television, or film, video, audio editing, etc. We want to promote products and projects that support the environment, encourage a healthy experience in living, developing, nurturing, and useful technology, and offering platforms for positive, socially constructive entertainment or informative, transformative media. Our experience in creating a variety of products like this is rather vast, and we offer client-based and collaborative products, as well as the opportunity of active investors to join us in the creation and promotion of proprietary products, some of which are in latter stages of development. For more information, go to www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. That's www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. If you're interested in talking to us, just fill out the contact sheet and we will get back with you.
If you're not fond of books, you may be interested in watching Dr. Rodier's slide presentation on his website, hugorodier.com. That's HUGORODIER.com. It lasts 48 minutes and explains the simple roots of all diseases with pictures and graphs that are easy to understand. The presentation includes basic principles of physics, philosophy, anthropology, and history to truly integrate the most vital pillars of human health.
I think a lot of us want our planet back, and here's the official song about that request by Patty Greer.
Everyone is waking up, and the animals are strong. Nature needs rebounding, so we're wishing on the stars. I'm just a kid at heart, and that is where we start. Who's in charge here?
Who's in charge here?
Let's do it differently. It's sickening all the people.
and it's killing all the trees. It's falling in our eyes, and it's getting harder to see the beauty that is our world and the freedom to be free. It's landing in the water, we know it's in the air. It's time for you and me to show we care. Say no to GMOs, hiding in our food, and no to fluoride in our water too. Who's in charge here? Let's save this family and do what's right for Earth and you and me. Step into the new way,
into the new way,
where we live in harmony. No more war, no more fracking, we are free.
Who's in charge?
Let's do it differently. Sickening all the people, and it's killing all the trees. It's falling in our eyes, and it's getting harder to see the beauty that is our world and the
freedom
to be free.
This is Johnny Bluestar back with the Integrative Hermetic Health Show. Dr. Rodier, our host, is about to embark on a journey of recovery for this serious problem that our culture has with physician suicide. So what can we do about this, doctor?
Well, first of all, it's awareness of the problem, which we've covered in the last two segments. I think the main thing that needs to happen is that doctors start to listen to their gut feelings in many ways. Number one, they need to be more cognizant of the relationship that's damaged with their patients. And so I think that's beginning to take place. And the focal point has been the digital medical records, and docs are fed up. They're just not relating to patients at all. Number two, gut feelings is a bit of a pun, nutrition. There is no doctor in the United States that does not know that nutrition has a huge impact on the health of their patients. But they're not able to act on it. They're not educated on that topic in medical school. They're so overwhelmed with the demands of a busy practice prescribing and writing that they just don't have the time to learn something they would have been best to learn in medical school. So I think that the system needs to be changed, and doctors can play a hand in it, in that they must have more education in nutrition and how that impacts the microbiome, the bacteria in the gut, and how that is a root of all diseases. I mean, I've been preaching this for, what, 3 decades? And there's not one new patient that doesn't come in my clinic and tells me, Doc, all doctors are now talking about the microbiome and how important nutrition is, but they tell me to go see a nutritionist to fix the problem. Or they prescribe me an antibiotic. And so I heard that you have been working on this for quite a while. And so that's how most of new patients come in. And so I think at a gut feeling, again, docs understand that this must be tackled. And it cannot be so done unless they have the time to inspire patients to change their diets. Punting to a nutritionist is not getting it done. So I think that's a fundamental issue Take, for instance, this blog I wrote a couple of weeks ago, and they can be found in my website, hugorodia.com, Nutritionally Deficient Doctors. It turns out that docs often make pronouncements about nutrition. They don't know what they're talking about. Like this poor guy, doc, saying that supplementation of vitamins and minerals and other nutrients is totally worthless. Really? I mean, you might find articles that back up that claim. Yeah, they're there. But you follow the money, they're written by the pharmaceuticals or people who are taking money from the status quo, people who control the status quo. But for every one of those articles, I can show you 1,000 saying that, yeah, supplementation should be done for many reasons. 1, our soils are depleted. 2, pesticides, food additives, all those chemicals interfere with nutrients. 3, marketing, shelving, canning, shipping totally compromises the nutritional content of foods. Take a can of peas. It doesn't have more than 20% of the nutrients a regular pea would have before all that processing, to say nothing about the chemicals that you are ingesting from that can, aluminum and BPA, a plastic that's put inside the can to coat the can so you don't get aluminum. Well, you still do, and now you get BPA with it. And those chemicals, any chemicals, they've been shown to interfere with the absorption, proper management, and incorporation of nutrients into the cell, the human cell. For instance, air pollution, that's the best example. It robs you of a whole lot of nutrients, mainly vitamin C and vitamin E. In fact, one single cigarette, which is the equivalent of breathing polluted air, well, some people have said a third of a pack would be more likely a day from living in Salt Lake City, for instance, which is very polluted.
Yeah.
So one single cigarette will rob you of 50 milligrams of vitamin C, which is the daily minimum requirement. And so, and then these poor doctors are telling people, look, just a balanced diet will do. Really? How many people in the United States eat a balanced diet? I mean, a handful? Yeah, it's like Lot looking for good people in Sodom and Gomorrah, finding people that really eats real well. So my point is, docs should look into mind-body training relating to patients, give up the digital medical records and get more time with patients to lollygag and talk about nutrition, and then read more. You know, I've blogged about this in the past, and we've talked about it extensively, Johnny, how doctors should go back to what they used to be, Renaissance shamans, if you will. Now, we're not going to do it in this present environment, but at least a recognition that a doctor is a human being, and so is the patient, and allow the doctor and the patient to discuss a book, a movie, something that touches their hearts. You know, that's the bottom line, Johnny. Are we touching people's hearts? And I don't mean with a stethoscope or with a scalpel. I mean touching people's souls and truly relating in a visit.
Well, in reality, how would you deploy this, these various concepts you presented, like nutrition and being more of a well-rounded person and being able to discuss things in a well-rounded way with their patients, and to be able to exercise compassion and knowledge of, you know, definitely the strong case for many things being the result of poor nutrition. But, I mean, how do you actually make this happen?
Okay, I believe that it's a political and economic question. And remember, I've taken some classes on a master's in health administration.
Right.
And it's not going to happen in the present environment. I think we're going to need a bit of a revolution here where doctors just refuse to be so put upon by the bean counters. And how's that going to happen? We need to reform the system at the funding, the economic part of the system. Like, I think a single-payer system would go a long way to facilitate this transition to where doctors have more of a voice. A single-payer system would get rid of a whole lot of overhead, a whole lot of demands by insurance companies that you have to write these extensive digital notes. So that right there would leave some time for the doctor to pursue his or her interests. Some will like to do acupuncture. Others will like to do more reading, more book assignments, others nutrition. But the point, the bottom line, the answer to your question is that we need to work on who's funding and paying for the system. And right now it's a business, and it was never meant to be a business. So I think models like, say, the Shriners Hospitals or St. Jude's, you know, hospitals that don't charge patients, they only charge up to their capacity to pay, are islands of excellence where patients and nurses and doctors are much more relaxed because they don't have these time demands from the people who are signing the check. And so it's going to be a fundamental revolution, but I'm not being an economist. I can't tell you more than that, other than we need to look at healthcare reform. And I don't mean who's covered and who's not. No, I mean reforming what the system does. You know, when the United States, this came out in the, I think, December issue of the National Geographic, and I blogged about that too. Did you know that the United States, we spend double what are the countries at the top with the best healthcare results, outcomes, pay per patient per year?
How much of that is how much of that is in pharmaceutical costs?
A big chunk, about a third, if I recall. But I think the figure is 10,000 per patient per year in the United States, where all those other countries, the top five in healthcare outcomes, France, Japan, Canada, Germany, Scandinavian countries.
It's amazing.
They pay half, and they have better longevity, less infant mortality, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I think another problem, excuse me, before we, I think another problem is the pharmaceutical problem. I mean,
yes.
Doctors are so influenced by these pharmaceutical companies and the kind of drugs and medication that they use that in a way that would discourage the real emphasis on nutrition, which would actually mean the absence of a lot of those substances.
Yes, you've elaborated on that point that I was trying to make. You know, by emphasizing nutrition, a whole lot of people would be able to get off pharmaceuticals. And even if we need pharmaceuticals, let's just say we do, because we do like 20% of the time, my estimate.
Yeah.
Because some people are not able or not willing to change their diets, or they have other fulminant type of health problems where they need more rescue. Yeah, there's a place for pharmaceuticals. But even then, all this stuff about new research, new drugs, you know, all they are, the new drugs with the, where do they get these names from? It's just amazing. I can't keep up with all the names of these new pharmaceuticals, which happen to be me too drugs, meaning they're no different, not much and not significantly, from the old generics that have been tried for decades that tend to have less side effects because they have been vetted through time. Whereas these new fandangled drugs, which tend to be 10 times more expensive, about a third of them are withdrawn from the market after they're truly tried in the real world for a few months. So, yeah, you're right. I think the pharmaceuticals are a big part of the problem.
And I think that's also impacts in medical school, right?
Oh, absolutely. Very good.
Where they gain
yes.
control over the doctor's mind and as well as his expenditure
exactly.
of energy and...
Exactly. Yeah. And then the professors at medical school turn out to be, for the most part, eggheads who are doing research on the minutest part of the body and is paid for, financed by a pharmaceutical. So when they go teach these poor medical students, they look at this tiny, tiny little part of the body and they make a big deal out of it and they micromanage it. And then they have to memorize every detail about that part of the body. I'm not saying nobody should be doing that, but the vast of doctors should be being taught in general terms. That's another problem. Turns out that we have 80% specialists, 20% generalists. It should be the other way around. And a lot of it is...
Well, I was just thinking with all these changes, you're really talking about cutting the, say, a national cost in healthcare by a tremendous amount, more than half, probably 60, 80%. Because you're going to a doctor and he's often telling you what to eat. And how to change your physical activities during the day. And there will be certainly a place for the pharmaceutical and surgical aspects of it, but it's going to reduce everything. It would actually make maybe getting a medical attention really affordable for most people.
Well, not only that, with all the savings you allude to, we could afford healthcare for all. And, you know, look at food stamps. Food stamps have demands and regulations to where you can't just walk in and buy cigarettes and alcohol with food stamps, right?
Right.
Well, if we're paying for the food stamps, you and I, Joe Public, because we are with our taxes, and I think it's a wonderful program, we have the right to say, how are you going to spend that, those food stamps, right?
Yeah.
Okay. If we're going to pay for health care, then we have a right to say, you need to undergo courses in nutrition, physical activity, or you don't like it? Well, then you don't qualify for the program. Sorry. You know, that might be a little too harsh for some people, but you know what? I never profess to be a Republican or a Democrat. So I'll just leave it at that.
Well, I think it should be demanded that that people who are going to medical school take those courses as not just a sort of a throw-in. I know it's probably done more than it was in the past, but I think it's still not really given the attention it deserves, no. Right?
Right. And some people will tell you, oh, we're too busy with the curriculum. Well, I say screw the curriculum, because 80% of it is minutiae that you promptly forget the minute you step out of medical school. So let's talk about meat and potatoes. So that's why I like the apprenticeship programs that are coming up in Europe.
Oh, yeah.
Where a student just follows a good old seasoned doc around and learns the ropes through this doc who's had real world experience with patients, with the system, instead of being stuck in a hospital for 120 hours and learning bad habits, not all the time, of course, but also learning a brutal system of approaching people.
I think that that learning system is probably one that should be used for a lot of professions, you know, because as far as I experienced high school and most of college, it was pretty academic and forgettable. It wasn't useful. And I spent a lot of years in high school, in college, learning different things. But I took a communications degree, and that was where you could actually learn broadcasting and journalism and advertising and all that. And you actually did things, and I actually could move them into what I was doing later on. Whereas the other things I studied, really, it was very academic in high school too. It just they just don't really care about the results, the real learning. I mean.
Right. Let me quote from Osler, William Osler, a Canadian thought to be the father of modern medicine. Nothing will sustain you more potently than the power to recognize in your humdrum routine, as perhaps it may be thought, the true poetry of life, the poetry of the commonplace, of the ordinary man, of the plain toil woman, with their loves and joys, their sorrows and their grief. The practice of medicine is an art, not a trade, a calling, not a business, a calling in which your heart will be exercised equally with your head, quote unquote.
Very nice. Well, thank you for letting us know about this really serious problem. And I think the last part of our show was a little bit more optimistic. Maybe there's something we can do about it.
So, hope springs eternal.
So suppose somebody wanted to have a phone consultation with you. How would they go about
log
that?
Just log on to my website, hugorodier.com. Phone numbers, blogs, newsletters, health classes are there.
Well, we'll see you next week, Doctor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Johnny.
Take care.
For more information about Dr. Rodier's practice, books, blogs, and newsletters, contact Hugo Rodier, MD, at www.hugorodier.com. That's HUGORODIER.com.
Now it's time to say goodbye.
And here's a beautiful ballad by Zave Music called Believe.
Stay strong and keep loving us. And we mustn't forget who we are, as a future and past are written in the stars. Every day of our life we should pray to the sky. We are one, we are loved. Much loss, and for that we will grieve. In the end, it is love we'll receive.